Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to your Infrequent Flying Podcast pilot episodes. We've been away for a bit, but now we are back and I have got my three fearless air people, air men, air warriors, whatever you want to call them, and they're here. First of all, there is the mild weasel, Godders. How are you, mate?
Mild weasel?
I like that. Mild weasel. I was out in America last week on a course. And I brought my wild weasel little patch with me so I could wear on my flying suit. I should have a mild weasel one. That's brilliant. Love that.
I thought you said mild weasel, and I thought that's brilliant.
That he did say
that. That's weasel. Exactly what I said.
Oh, there you go. Don't turn it all cool as wild weasel.
Go and get your hearing trumpet, Parky.
Don't For deflect that one. Sake.
Old weasel.
Yeah, now
old and deaf weasel.
I was fascinated by something.
The reason that we haven't had a podcast for so long is because JB's been making up these pithy intros.
Exactly, okay. And it takes me absolutely months. Also, did you know this? The Horde Words of the Year got to pay for a one-star general to go on a course about how to fight a war. I would have assumed that would be second nature, but that's where you've been, right, Godders?
I have been on a very interesting course. Called the Coalition Forces Air Component Commander course, and it was brilliant.
Sounds
got
awesome.
To speak to a million four-star generals about how they do stuff, leadership, lessons from previous campaigns from Afghanistan, from Iraq, all sorts of stuff. It was amazing, and met up with a couple of blokes that I hadn't seen for a million years. Well, 20 that I was on exchange with, so it was awesome. Really, really good.
Excellent.
God, I've never heard of you referred to as a general before, but I think that's what JB called you, isn't it? A one-star general.
That's what we've got to call him.
Well, so, exactly. I forced them to, because the rank in America, the other one stars on the course, there was a couple of two stars and a three star. But the USAF rank is Brigadier General. So they accidentally slipped into calling me General Godfrey, and I'm forcing my family to do exactly that.
I'm going to call you General Godfrey. Even in fact, social circles.
I mean,
in fact, the US Army one star on the course liked the term Air Commodore so much he wanted to be called the Ground Commodore.
Ah, I like it. I mean, the weird thing is I met up with Godders a few weeks ago in Twickenham and he made me change on my phone from Paul Godfrey to General Godfrey. So he's taking it very seriously.
That's me.
Quite right.
Now,
it's all about self-promotion.
Now, before we can...
I have self-promoted. That's the only way I got to Air Commodore.
Now, before we continue, I do have a question for you, Godders. And it is this. You brought it up almost by accident. But you said you got to wear a flying suit all week, which I will come to in a minute. But you said you like the flying suit because you have to wear badges all over it. And here's my question. Who designs the badges?
Oh, now in the UK...
Yes.
We have...
He does his own. Does all his own badges.
I make my own. In the UK, it's Squadron Prince. So Jill and Barry Vissers, who are based up in up near Lucas, they are. If you've JB, you must have seen the prints of aeroplanes. You know that a lot of people have framed. That all of the squadrons have them done. You know, a specific. Side on view of a squadron aeroplane and a little spiel that says what the squadron had done and all that sort of stuff. So for years they took over this particular company that had been started I guess about 30 or 40 years ago and are massive friends of the Royal Air Force and the other services as well. So they branched out into badges and do millions of badges. So the Typhoon badge I was wearing was done by them. I think my name badge was done by them as well.
General Godfrey.
Wow.
Massive in that's 37 really cool. font General, and then 2 font Godfrey.
Does it light up?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that would be good to have flashing lights around it.
Have you ever
got it like as a full back patch, you know, so on the back of the jacket? General Godfrey.
But you guys know, if anyone could do that, Squadron Prince could do that.
Yeah. Very nice.
What I just want to point out, the thing on the podcast has all been about calling God as General Godfrey.
Yeah.
Carry on.
Well, that noise there, Duncan. How are we?
It's why we've been away so long. It's good.
If ever there was an inappropriate name,
I don't know what you mean.
There's a song in there, isn't there?
I believe you can make some sort of song.
Skull Crusher to Mild Thing.
Mild Thing. It's funny because since we last spoke, I think I've been demoted. It's all very well, you know, General got hoi polloi and his high ranking tooting and shooting. I don't know.
He's run out of words.
I've run out of words.
He's off the end of the runway.
But I got demoted.
But you have been flying. In fact, you were flying yesterday.
It was almost inevitable, Dan.
It was inevitable, yeah.
Yeah.
But you were flying yesterday, right? Are we flying today? Tell us about that.
Yeah. I had my instrument rating test today. That means for flying in cloud.
How was it? We could probably, but I bet that's quite complicated in one of those little things, isn't it? In a prefect.
It's the most simple thing you can imagine. The aeroplane helps you enormously, which is great. But I literally spent the whole trip thinking, I've missed something. I must have missed something because everything is there in front of you. As you say, we'll probably get into it in a bit, but you know, it's all glass cockpit and it really is designed really well. So it helps you enormously in poor weather. And so it's great. It's really good.
And you still fail.
I still failed. Yeah.
Say whether he passed.
So
cloud penetration.
It turns out the reason that I was thinking I must have missed something is because I had a lot.
The runway most of the time.
So we all know you to be a model instructor. What are you like as a pupil, Dunk?
I don't know. You'd have to ask someone else, wouldn't you?
Well, I mean, would you look at your own behaviour? If you were watching yourself third person, would you look at your own behaviour and say, that's how I want all of my students to behave? Or would you grade yourself differently?
Constant back chat.
Yeah. No. I'm not going to do it like that. I'm going to do it. Watch this.
It's not the first rule, sir.
Yeah, exactly. No. Well, the thing is, so today I was flying with Charlie Brown, who I've flown with previously in all sorts of different aeroplanes, but Parky flies with him down at Flying Legends at Headcorn, and so but he's a delight to fly with, and he's, I'm sure he's being mildly eccentric, but he's great to fly with, and always has wise words.
Anyway,
what was his conclusion to the sortie, Dunk? Did he punch you very hard?
I think it was just on short finals. I have control.
Sure, he didn't swear first after screaming.
I don't think Charlie swears, does he? That's only very occasionally. You know that he's serious then. Yeah, no, it was. It all seemed to go all right. Thanks for asking.
Excellent.
So anyway, to answer your question, JB, I think so. I don't know. It's an awkward question, isn't it? I hope so, but I don't know. You would have to ask someone else.
We might just do that.
I'll ask Charlie and I'll give us a full report.
Well, yes. I mean, if anyone's Charlie's number.
Did you not do some C2I stuff with him in the chippy?
I'm trying to think. It was... We must have done Dunk. Did I do some
The thing C2I is, stuff? We banter, but Parky and I have flown together an awful lot, and I think we can safely say that that we're probably on the same wavelength, aren't we, Parco?
Yes, I think we tend to have quite a laugh, really.
In a very professional way.
Yeah, obviously.
I flew with Parky a lot more because Duncan and I could not help but nib each other the whole time. I remember one particular sortie where, what was it, a 70-knot climb in a chipmunk?
Yeah.
And I said, "Oh, look at that, Dunk, 65 knots. And he went, "No, that's best rate of climb. I'm doing this on purpose." An answer for everything. That's what he's got.
Then he used to say, if you did that, he'd go, "No, you don't get such good cooling. That's why you need to do it at 70. I can remember him saying that.
And you can see over the nose better.
Well, I mean, I guess we're 10 minutes in. We should really introduce the man who's probably in a mild hibernation now. Parky.
Now that is very accurate.
I was going to say, this is literally when you do nothing, right? It's nice and dark. All the fields are covered in mud. Spitfires are nicely tucked away in heated hangars.
Kind of. I mean, we're actually going to, fingers crossed, if the weather holds out, we're going to do a couple of Spitfires on the wing of a Dakota full of veterans. Ooh. And I think I'm going to have a veteran in the back of the two-seater and fly over Cape Le Fern on Sunday. Remembrance Day, and they're going to do a poppy drop over the sea. So there's a cunning plan for some aviation to occur if the weather allows.
Excellent. Wow. It's looking all right, isn't it, Parco?
I think so. It's a bit, yeah, it's sort of...
I think it's all blowing through on Saturday, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a bit of a front, but it's just hopefully that will knob off to the east and we'll be able to get it in. Or maybe we'll just sort of slip a little bit sort of later on. But it'd be lovely to do that, and, you know, a load of veterans out of North Weald on Sunday would be great.
Can we mention how all of us love displaying at Capel Le Fern?
That's a good one. That is very true. Some of our belters have been there underneath the cliffs.
Well, okay. I mean, I don't know where this place is, let alone displayed there. Why don't you tell me why it's so good to display at?
Well, it's the memorial to the few at Cape Le Fern, which is just to the east side of Folkestone. So there's a fabulous, you know, you can visit it on the ground. All the names of the few inscribed in on a big slab there, sort of 3,000 or so of them. And then there's a pilot sort of looking out to sea.
I think that understates it, Harvey. I think that understates it, doesn't it? It's a huge pilot. It's a huge sculpture of a pilot sat looking out to sea on a three-bladed propeller, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's sort of in the chalk. So from the air, you know, that's our sort of one of the aero legends to either fly with, or we've got a mate in the back of the two-seater. We always fly over the memorial to one of those boys. And it's great from the air. It stands out because the three-bladed propeller, as Dunk said, is in chalk, and it, you know, it just jumps out at you. And even it's very good. The restaurant's got there's a sort of restaurant there, and that's got an elliptical wing. So from the air, it just looks a great place. But on the ground, you know, you're looking out over the sea towards, obviously, towards France, and to display there, it's fantastic. You're out over the sea, you can sort of duck down over the sea, so actually the crowd can't see you, and then when you pull up, you know, you're just sort of smack bang in front of them. And it's just a magical place to display at. I think we've probably all displayed there when a few of the few have been there, and that, you know, obviously made it even, if it could be more special, but just unbelievable. You know, I remember we'd meet the boys. It was always that weekend, wasn't it, Dunk, where we meet the boys in Ashford, the few, and have some beers with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, and chat to, you know, Jeff Wellham, Ken Wilkinson, Paul Farnes, all those boys. And it was just brilliant, utterly brilliant.
There was a lovely story about Paul Farnes. So we went and did that display at the, in fact, I think it may have been 2015, where the weather precluded us getting there. And we took, what, six fighters down there? Was it six fighters or was it four?
It was four
of us trying to get down there. And I tried my damnedest to get us in there, but the weather wouldn't let us get in, would it? But we then went to dinner in the evening, and I was sat next to Paul Farnes, and Paul's still around, and he was a Battle of France man, flew Hurricanes, and then he was in the Battle of Britain, and I was sat next to him. I hadn't met him before, and Geoffrey Wellham was sat on the table just across the way. And after the dinner, I saw Jeff was getting up, and generally he would go to the bar, wouldn't he? He would sort of go, I'm going to the bar.
Oh, yeah.
So, and I said, to Paul Farnes, I said, it looks like Jeff's off. And Paul went, I don't know why anyone makes such a fuss about that bloke. He wasn't even in the Battle of France.
Paul Farnes is delightfully sort of grumpy's the wrong word, but he's got a twinkle in his eye. But did he tell you his logbook story, Dunk?
I don't think he did.
He in the Battle of France, they're obviously just being overrun, and he ends up leaving his logbook somewhere in France. It's like, oh, bugger, I've left my logbook behind. And he manages, I'm fairly sure, he somehow gets to Jersey, and from there he manages to find a hurricane, like you do, and flies back. And that's how he sort of escaped back to the UK. Fights in the Battle of Britain, fights throughout the whole war, and eventually, I think it's kind of somewhere in Holland, they're at a Luftwaffe base, and now it's 1944, they're now taking over with the Germans in full retreat. And bizarrely, at this Luftwaffe base, some mate finds his logbook.
What?
But the punchline of the story from Paul was, he goes, yes, but I'd already started a new one. It was bloody annoying.
Blimey. Yeah. How does that even work?
What are the chances of that?
Slim.
Yes. Well, I displayed at Capel once, I think, but it was a beautiful sunny day. There were some of the few down below. I think I might have been on your one. We just had a belter of a time, I do remember, because you got the White Cliffs there. You're in proper fighter country. It's the memorial to the Battle of Britain, and you've got some of the few down. It doesn't get any better than that, does it?
That's it.
It's pretty cool.
Especially displaying below a cliff. I just love that.
Now, speaking about the few, I am rereading at the moment, and I'm two-thirds of the way through First Light.
Ooh.
Ooh. I told you, on the way down to Jeffrey's funeral, I reread it last year. Yeah. It's amazing. You forget how good it is, don't you?
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And yesterday, the weather was awful yesterday, and I've just got just past the bit where they're at Manston. So they've gone through the Battle of Britain, they're at Manston, and he's just being launched off in the miserable
on that bad day.
With no diversions, cloud-based, low already and lowering.
The possible hosing of the rain. 88.
Is that the mission where he follows his mate Tom, and Tom has instruments all the way from wherever they were based, all the way up to the far end of Scotland to look for condors?
No, his radio goes, doesn't it? It's full of water, and they manage to lose each other.
Yeah,
and
it was Tom.
He has a squirt at a Junkers 88, and he sees the gear come down. That's how. Do you remember that when we saw that? Was it the BBC who did the sort of adaptation of it, and we yes. went to the screening of it, and that's how that film started, with that scene in the rain.
Yeah,
we went down to London.
That's it.
Yeah. And yesterday the weather was similar. As I looked out of the window at the aeroplanes, as flying was cancelled because of the weather. It's funny to think, you know, poor old Jeff, and he describes it as despair, as looking out the window in despair, but with no choice. They're being launched, him and his mate, just the two of them, and off they go into awful weather, knowing that there's a 50-50 chance they just can't get back.
Oh, do you remember he catches doesn't he catch a glimpse of the land and ends up sort of schneebling his way back in, then recognising something and finding, was he from Manston or Biggin Hill at that point?
Manston.
And then, you know, managing to get in there. Hey, yeah. on a similar note, when I was out in America last week, I went and saw Shieldsy, John Shields,
who
I know Parky will know, and I think
yeah, I know. You as well.
But Shieldsy's on the what's called the Air War College out in
Alabama, is it?
Alabama in Maxwell. Mm. JB, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, I thought you disappeared.
No, no.
So one thing he said, he listens, and for some reason, finds it amusing. So, Shilzy, thanks for giving me a couple of beers the other week and taking me out for pizza. That was very nice. But the second thing he mentioned was he just read Nine Lives by Al Dear, which I don't think I've read. You know, it's one of the ones from the Second World War that I haven't. And the link was that he was, when he started War College in the States, which was, you know, the beginning of this term, if you like, he was looking at all of the pictures of previous courses that had gone through. And the very first War College that they did, where they invited a foreign, I think it might have actually been the first one, where they invited foreign students, was in 1946. And Al Dear was on that particular course. And I was thinking, can you imagine that course, you know, because it's about war studies and it's about that sort of stuff, learning lessons and everything, having just come out of a 6-year fully global Second World War that had ended with, you know, hydrogen bombs and all sorts of stuff. That must have been amazing, the stories on a course like that. But, you know, just reminded me of the link and also reminded me I need to read Nine Lives.
Yeah, it's I've definitely read it. There's an amazing bit in Dunkirk when they do a rescue mission. One of the boys get shot down, so they launched the sort of squadron, Oster or whatever. What was that? They had a sort of you know,
a bystander or a was it a called a walrus?
No, it was just a little sort of 2-seater that they just do some training in, and they a couple of them with some, you know, some spit escort. They literally just went and landed, picked the mate up, they rescued him with 109 strafing them. But how Al Dear describes that, it's just brilliant. There was one above cloud, one below. He knew his mate was doing all right above cloud because 109s kept crashing around him. You know, it just ridiculously brilliant.
Hey, now I got as we're doing book recommends, I guess. Now I was telling the boys as I was looking out the window, saying I'm, you know, about First Light and the piece we just.
When you say the boys, is this other young students that around
students,
you that are going
yes,
through
other filthy students on the course? Yeah, no, it was
instructor students or students going through first time.
No, it's instructor. Well, actually, I was in the instructor's room, so I was.
Ooh, don't mix with the young'uns.
Are you allowed in there?
Yeah, no, I was only in sort of trying to find my logbook, probably before I got kicked out. Get out, Mason.
I have visioned of it being a bit like Ted Stryker in Aeroplane on the plane, where you sit down next to someone, start ditting on, and the camera pans back every now and again, and they're covering themselves in petrol.
We have lost a few actually in the last few weeks, particularly on bad weather days. It's been been a bit of a, but you know, operation that size, bound to lose a few, aren't you?
Yeah. Sorry, your book.
Yeah. So one of the boys was recommending Sagittarius Rising. Have you read that?
That's why isn't that the World War One?
Yeah.
Book?
Yeah. It is. Yeah.
No, I haven't read that. I haven't read any. I've got one ready to go, actually. I just haven't started it yet. But I haven't read any World War
I. There was lots of, you know, of coups of yeah, that is the most fantastic book as well. Brilliantly written. Just another Wellham-esque type book. But, of course, a First World War rather than Second. But so I'm going to, I think we should all pledge to have it.
Yeah, yeah. Anyone out there listening, just send us a quick book review of it. So, you know, we haven't read it, so tell us what you think.
Yeah, and also don't forget, boys, we do have those two books which we need to sign and send to someone. I can't remember who.
He's given up now.
Yeah, but we will get his books.
We are going to get it to you.
I have those two books on my bookshelf ready to go.
Right. Sounds like we are at competitions. Now, JB, you have been in some aeroplanes recently, haven't you?
I've been in lots of aeroplanes.
Seen some aeroplanes somewhere on the planet.
Yeah, I completely forgot. I've not spoke to you since that. But yeah, I was over in Japan, and it turned out that they have quite a lot of hardware, which is quite openly out on display. So you can hardly look into the sky in Japan without seeing a P3 Orion. But I nipped down to the island of Okinawa, as you often do. And yeah, they've got all sorts of things there. They've got F-15s, they've got P-3s out there, they've got E-2 Hawk. Is it Hawkeye, the
E-2? Yeah, E-2.
Yep.
Two C's and D's.
Were you sort of garnering information for your handler?
I would absolutely never do that. Never do that ever. I was very disappointed, though, not to see their new submarine Hunter, which is the Mitsubishi, I think I want to call it a P2 or something, but it's a cool-looking bit of kit. But yeah, it was all quite cool to see. Also disappointed not to see any US Marine stuff on Okinawa.
Did you not?
No, nothing. No,
interesting.
No Ospreys, no F-18s, no Harriers, no nothing.
There are lots of them around there. But yeah, it's unsurprising they've got all of that kit. I think I may have mentioned on a pod previously, when we took the Typhoons to Japan from Lossiemouth, they gave us a brief when we got there. And, you could read anything in the papers these days or see on the news, but it's quite an interesting place.
Yeah,
given
very
that
much
they're
so.
A defense force. But they've got, obviously, they've got Russia to the north, China out to the west, and North Korea firing missiles over the top of them when they're doing their missile testing. So,
ridiculously, yeah. They don't even get on with South Korea. So, you know, all in all, it feels like a fairly hostile place.
It's definitely an interest. It's clearly an awful lot of stuff going on in that world, and minor earthquakes and big typhoons rolling through when you're in Japan as well.
And Godzilla. how long does it take
you? JB, did you go and look at the talking of the U.S. Marine Corps? Did you go and look at the monuments? Is the famous monument of the flag being?
That's Iwo Jima, isn't it?
Is it? Did I get that wrong?
Yeah, I think you might have. But to answer your question, Dunk, I am the world's worst tourist. What I like is bars, restaurants and cities. I have very little time for sightseeing. In fact, broadly none. If I stumble over a monument, I'll have a quick look. But other than that, I'm purely focused on enjoying myself. So, yeah, I am literally the world's most ungrateful tourist.
I thought you went to some sort of relaxing sauna type area in the foothills of Mount Fuji or something.
Yes, we did that. I literally slept for 2 days. I slept for 2 days. I was out there for just under 3 weeks. And those 2 days, I give you my word, I slept for pretty much 48 hours solid because that was our little break. In case the listeners are wondering what on earth I'm talking about, I'm talking about my other podcast, Egg Chasers, which is rugby based, which I unfortunately had to go out to the World Cup for just under 3 weeks.
Yeah, and be together for so long because there's been quite a lot of world going on, right?
Exactly.
Goddard has been as it's just JB and Goddard's really flung to the four winds. Oh no, Parky, you've been off as well. You've been with Malesh.
Yeah. With very interesting, with Ryanair. Fascinating.
how was Ryanair?
They were on time, it's good.
Just
you have to fly it.
No,
we've all got. Hello,
you're back.
Right, just a quick one. Do you know when you took the typhoons over to Japan? How long does that whole process last? Do you jump in a typhoon over in the UK, get there in what, 18 hours?
Well, so in order to maximise the trip out there, we flew to Malaysia first. So that was a trip that went. From what I remember, we had tankers flew to Cyprus. We went from Cyprus to Saudi Arabia to India, and then India to Malaysia. Once we were in Malaysia, we did a almost three-week exercise out there. And then it was another squadron. So I went out for the last week of that particular exercise. As the squadrons crossed over, another squadron flew out from the UK on one of our Voyager aircraft that was, bringing a bunch of stuff out anyway.
Yeah.
And then I jumped on the Voyager, clearly didn't pull rank and fly an aeroplane. And that was amazing, actually. I hadn't been in the cockpit of a Voyager, and obviously you don't get to fly in the cockpit of A330s, these days with the cockpit doors shut. But having done the A380 sim that we did with British Airways, exactly the same cockpit, apart from the mission system bit, which is behind the seats.
Yes.
Where it was a warrant officer who was sat there, basically in charge of the air-to-air refueling. So they've got additional panels so that they can transfer the fuel from the regular fuel tanks in the Voyager to the drogues that come out the side of the pods or come out the back of the pods on the side of the airplane. And this awesome TV system where one of the few times in my life I get to watch other people tank under extreme pressure because they don't want to be the one that diverts the trail to to South Korea or the Republic of Korea or anything like that. With a, you know, eating a curry and watching them thrash around on this thing in some, you know, reasonably horrendous weather.
No,
just a bit. And then we let it. So, yeah, go on.
Do Malaysia have? I'm probably going to embarrass myself. Do they have Sukhoi Su-30s?
Yeah. So Malaysia got a massive mix of airplanes.
Have they?
In fact, I did a particularly good trip on that exercise. Bersama Lima was the exercise where we took off out of Penang, flew across Malaysia out towards the east, out into the South Sea there, and we were doing a ship attack sortie amongst this huge fleet of, you know, this huge sea battle was going on whilst being bounced by Su-27s. It was brilliant. I loved it.
Nice. Do you remember, Dunk, we did, in fact, Goddess, was the Langkawi Air Show at the same time? Did one of the jets display there?
Probably. Yeah, it was around that sort of time, yeah. They normally try and time it, so you're not flying just asynchronous out to.
Old years it used to be the Langkawi, but Dunk and I did the Langkawi Air Show with the Reds. It was brilliant, same sort of hopping you know, around the world. But I can remember that same question you asked, JB. It was like the Malaysians, they had some MiG-29s, and it was quite a sort of, they just kind of snorted the joint and, you know, duffed up the air show, you know, up and down the line for a bit.
And did they snort it or did they snot it?
Which one?
Yeah. They've snorted the joint.
Snorted.
It's you're thinking about snorting. Your week in Marrakesh.
I can't say, was it fraudulent slip?
Fraudulent slip. Parky, are you drunk?
No, not at all.
No.
But the Malaysians, they also had F-18s at the time, and they just had this utter mismatch of bizarre, you know, east and west aircraft. I don't know why they had that sort of policy, but they had, you know, they'd literally buy anything, it would appear.
Well, I guess, from their point of view, if you have lots of different suppliers, you're never going to be reliant on just one supplier and one relationship. It's the only logical thing I can think of.
Yeah, that's exactly. India are the same, you know, in terms of it's more expensive because you've got lots of different supply chains. But, you know, if someone, you end up having an argument and sanctions with someone, then someone else is, you know, going to increase the amount of kit they give you.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess it may make sense in that part of the world.
And how did you get on against the Su-27s?
Good. It was a shame because they ended up, they were above a hard deck that they were using, and we were below and couldn't pull up into them because we were in this sort of ship attack area, and so we didn't get any full dogfighting in, but we were, you know, reacting to their medium range missiles and some of their short range missiles and stuff like that. So it was brilliant. I loved it.
So why would you design the exercise like that? Because presumably, you know, real life, you're going to either engage them or they're going to engage you.
Yeah, it sometimes depends on what you want to get out of a particular exercise. So if you go to a red flag, for example, out in the US, there'll be all sorts of mechanisms where you can pull up, transition through various altitudes and so on in order to, you know, to have that dogfight, if that's what it's come to. But in this particular case, it was more about the sea power side of it in that point of the exercise. So as much as they tried to integrate the air power, it was more about the battle that they were having at sea, reacting to us on sort of bombing raids and so on. And their sort of friendly fighters, which were the Su-27s being called in, you know, we were the enemy on that particular day. So it all depends on the type of exercise, and it all depends on the day in the exercise, depending on what the focus is.
There you go. Extreme, you've flown against or more alongside Su-27s and Su-30s.
No, I haven't done. No, I've never done a fill with them. I've done some stuff with MiG-29s, but that's probably the only sort of MiG or Sukhoi Eastern Bloc stuff that I've fought. What about you, Dunk?
No, I don't think I've done any Eastern Bloc stuff at all. I think, you know, there was we didn't generally go and do air defence stuff, of course, because we were ground attack people, so we didn't really and mix it up with those guys. But we did.
Did you ever fly missions out in Afghanistan or anything like that with anyone flying sort of Eastern type equipment?
Nope. No, all Western type.
In fact, I'm just thinking the one time I flew on the wing of an SU-27 was, it must have been kind of in 2000 at an air show. They had a sort of East meets West theme, and you kind of, they put a sort of great, I don't know, maybe 16 ship, you know, all sort of 30 seconds apart, and there was sort of old aircraft, East and West, and some sort of 60s, 70s, and they, for whatever reason, they paired up the F3 with the Flanker, which I thought was quite cool. So I had this this
amazing similar thing. Performance, that's probably why.
Yeah, exactly. But for whatever reason, the it was a Crusader. They were sort of ahead of us, and this French Navy Crusader managed to burst his tires and black the runway, and we were landing behind. So we then diverted about 5 miles to Bryson Orton from Fairford, you know, with this Flanker mate on my wing. And I remember at the time we sort of just landed. We had to wait till they cleared the runway, and we sort of showed. I jumped into his Flanker, and he jumped into my F3. I'm not sure he was that impressed. And then we took him back, and it was a bit of a fun day, to be honest.
Oh, nice. What do you think of the inside of a Flanker?
It was
probably painted sky blue and green.
Yeah, weird colours, the kind of, funny green colour, but I don't seem to recall an obvious where is the radar. You know, there was a sort of head-up display and the general instruments. It was fairly, you know, old tech at the time. This is sort of 19 years ago. But I you know, every aircraft from the F4, F3, F16, you know, there was an obvious, well, there's the radar. That's what you're looking at, you know, when you're...
Same in the Harrier.
Yeah, exactly. It was more like having that's what I seem to recall, you know. And some of it was quite funky and modern, and some of it was ridiculously old looking. You know, it was a funny sort of mismatch of those two. But it's a big jet.
Oh, it's huge, isn't it? It's absolutely enormous. If you compare it to an F-16 or F-18, it's huge.
Yeah, it was massive. Sort of, you know, literally parked side by side with the Tornado, and it was like, somebody's brought a little joke Tornado in. Oh, it's mine.
Yeah. Well, see, it was interesting, wasn't it, Parky, when the I didn't get to do it, but when the Indians brought their SU-30s, I think they were, so, you know, Flanker derivative, into the UK and did the big exercise over here. Yeah. And there was a lot of guys to go up and fight against them. Some interesting results, because no one is interested in the results in that long range war. All you ever want to get into is a bit of mano v mano dogfighting.
Well, they were quite boastful.
Glad you said that.
Say again, maybe?
Well, they were quite, if I seem to remember my Twitter correctly, weren't they quite boastful about the about the events?
Well remembered there, JB. Yeah, they were. And that, you know, so there was a bit of definite bit of banter on there, you know. I think someone had said on Twitter, "Oh, we won 12-1 or something like that," but it definitely wasn't like that. It was, you know, that there was a difference in the way that the aircraft were configured. So, you know, that medium to long range war, that you know, it went very, very well for, and also we had mixed sides as well, so you couldn't exactly say, you know, it was Sukhois versus Typhoons the whole time. But when it came to basic fighter maneuvers, there were mixed results, but it was obvious that the Indians had brought every single one of their really experienced pilots, you know, that all guys in their late 20s, early 30s with multiple tours on this aeroplane. And we were just throwing up, you know, guys who'd only just qualified on it and go and have a go, because it's great experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's various mixed results, because in any of those fighters these days, you can still come down to one mistake in turning the wrong direction or putting in the wrong move, and you're you know, and you can be defensive. Honestly, it's a bit like the World Cup at the weekend, you know, a couple of wrong moves and you're on the back foot, and it's really hard to get back on the front foot.
Now,
Gribbers, has there been a just 1v1 visual doggers with the Brits flying F-35s and Typhoon yet?
I think there has been, but I don't know how they got on, because that would have been with, because 17, 41 Squadron, the Typhoon test evaluation squadron, had definitely been out to Edwards and done that sort of stuff. But I must admit, I don't know how that's got on. Certainly when we did one of the last big exercises I did on the Typhoon was Trilat out in the USA. And we were with F-22, F-35 and Rafale. And the first week of that was a BFM week. But I don't think, because the F-35s were new into service at that point, they didn't have their full G limit, because the 35A is a 9G aeroplane.
Yeah.
They didn't do the BFM. So on that particular week, I went off and I did BFM, basic fighter maneuvers, dogfighting against an F-22.
At that time, they'd have had the second series of software, so they wouldn't have been able to fly particularly hard anyway.
No, this is exactly right. You know, that was almost 3 years ago now, so it was very early models. But what amazed me when we got out and we were doing the big mission. So, you know, essentially, once we'd done that week, we then worked up into bigger missions where Rafale, F-35, F-22 and Typhoon were there to defend an area. So you'd fly out to, you know, maybe go to a tanker, all set up at one side of an area that may be, you know, 150 miles wide, and it's up to you to defend your area. And they sent up a squadron or two, so a lot of aeroplanes of F-15s and F-18s and all sorts of things that would come at us.
Ooh, exciting.
And the F-35 was utterly brilliant. I didn't expect it to have the fuel that it did. It hung out there for the entire, what we call the vulnerability period. And, you know, whilst all of the other aeroplanes were replacing each other and, you know, sending more jets in to, you know, make sure that we could stay the distance. And the other brilliant thing that it did, it's a bit like a quarterback in American football in that it sort of sits there, sees the entire picture and then decides what's going on. So, you know, where you, and it will also data link stuff to us as well. So I could be what we call cold, i.e. running away, always running away, Duncan, running away from the threat, having just had an engagement. And even at that point, normally if you've got the link, the data link, you can see what's going on your situational display behind you and where everything is and come up with a game plan as to how you're going to pitch back. But with the F-35s providing a ton more information, you had everything the whole time, you know, and we're wearing the, everyone out there, I think, including Rafale, had the helmets where you're seeing all the information in your visors. So everyone's heads out of the cockpit, and it was amazing, you know.
Right.
I was fortunate that I did have situational awareness in one trip before I stopped flying the fighters.
I've got a super nerdy question.
Go on.
Okay. If you've got an F-35 in the air, with all its sensory data and the data fusion and data links and all the rest of it, where does this, what role does an AWACS still have to play?
So an AWACS can, you know, is as well as just the radar and doing the long range sort of early warning, it's got that endurance to be up there for, you know, hours and hours and hours. It's a Boeing 707. So, you know, they can do some reasonably long stuff. But B, it's got all sorts of different radios that you can put on it because it's a big, hefty carrying platform where you can, and a bunch of people where you can do all sorts of different command and control. So, you know, there'll be people looking at the electronic warfare that's going on. There'll be people looking at the radar stuff that's coming in. There'll be people looking at other different things. And they'll be in touch with whoever's commanding that particular, you know, battle or whatever you want to call it, the area of regard. And so, you know, it's much more than just a radar and telling us what's out there. It's a command and control platform where they can rebroadcast all sorts of things, big by SATCOM and stuff like that.
Why is that not safer to be done on the ground, though? Why do they need to be flying for that?
Well, because so you can imagine if you've got a radar on the ground and you're looking, then your shadow, then you've only got that radar horizon that you can see. But you put a
I understand why the radar needs to be flying, but why do the people need to be flying for command and control?
I think we're moving away from that sort of stuff these days, but there are advantages in terms of, you know, whether it's radio range, whether it's, you know, a whole host of other reasons that you you put someone up in that particular area that you can then sort of rebroadcast around the place. So a bunch of different reasons, really. But, you know, we still, it's still good to have that sort of platform out there, that command and control. And they can also carry other things these days, you know, sort of rebroadcasting pods, pods that turn certain data links, translate them and send them out in other data links, you know, all of that sort of stuff.
So the thing which I see that the big
spin... JB, you're probably right in a way, JB, now with F-35, you know, when that thing is on the link, its picture at times will... you know, conceivably be better than the AWACS is, and it will be, you know, putting, you know, onto the link stuff that the E3 can't see, you know.
I'll go back to American football, JB. You know, it's just like, it's having that sort of the, you know, the quarterback on the field who's doing that for the tactical side. But then, you know, whilst you might have the coach, the head coach on the sideline, you might have the offense and defensive coaches high up in the stands with a bigger picture of what's going on.
That's a nice analogy. I like that.
You love it. You can spend a couple of weeks in America and look, he's all about the American football, isn't he? Is that, I bet you that's what they taught you on that Warfighters course, isn't it? Right. Use analogies in American football.
Well, did I tell you when, because I don't, had I been to Dallas Fort Worth to the F-35 factory when we spoke last time?
Not that we've heard of.
No, I don't think so.
Yes, yeah, so I went back out there. That must have been a month ago, a bit more than that. And on, we had to get there for a thing in the evening, and we got there about lunchtime. So, you know, a couple of boys wanted to just, all right, try and get over the jet lag for 2 hours before we go to a meeting. But I went, right, we're getting in the car. And we went to the Dallas Cowboys AT&T Stadium and did a tour. Utterly amazing.
I bet it is.
£1.2 billion stadium where we got to see around everywhere, go out on the pitch, into the locker rooms. It was flipping brilliant. And that's
On the American football analogy, God, as you're kind of more like,
there's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
A cheerleader, really, aren't you?
Yes.
You can get your legs quite high.
Water yeah. boy.
No, nice right, set of legs
right,
as well.
Right behind his ears.
Yeah, nice set of legs. sorry, Dunk, with all this modern aircraft banter, we've been leaving you out the conversation, haven't we?
I was just having a little kip. But now I can just think of
reminiscing about the old days.
Yeah. He's thinking about his instrument rating refly.
Yeah, exactly. It's quite a big deal.
One thing I was going to mention, see, me being inclusive, bringing you into this, and actually I have got another story about Japan that I need to talk about, but
yes, okay.
One of the things we haven't talked about is, did you follow the Reds tour on Twitter? I thought that was flipping amazing what those guys got up to out in the US. And I was,
I did
I
actually.
Don't think after you guys.
Yep, I followed them.
Say again, JP.
I saw them flying in New York.
So as a, you know, a civilian there, JB, what did you think of the of what they were doing and what they were getting up to?
Well, I only saw the one in New York. I don't know, really. I mean, what was it depends on what the purpose of the tour was. I mean, was it just to, you know, raise national prestige and tell the Americans a bit about the RAF, effectively?
Yeah, you know, it's more than the RAF. I think it's, I mean, these boys would be able to tell you, but it's more about Britain. You know, the Union Jacks underneath the aeroplanes, the Red Arrows, they displayed at all the big air shows out there from the East Coast to the West Coast through to Canada.
So I always wonder about that. I quite like it because I look at it and I think, oh, that's pretty cool, Britain abroad, so on and so forth. But I always wonder if the audience that they're talking to are the foreign audience or it's the domestic audience, people like me.
I think there's probably a bit of both. I think the domestic audience, there's you know, they will enjoy that enormously. But I think probably at the heart of it, it's a business opportunity. I had just got sent a text yesterday from a good friend of mine called Pete Sharp, who I went through flying training with, and he's now with British Airways. And he was out on the water, I think in Maine, I think is where he said he was. But he said there's a lot of BA Systems stuff over here, and sent some pictures through. You know, the fact is that we think BA Systems just sits in this country and produces UK defence stuff, but it's a global company, of course. And I don't think it should be underestimated. You know, the projection, certainly, you know, Parky was talking about the Langkawi tour that we went on in 2003. And it's a huge defence air show. And it's not really, although there's a public day, it's mostly about commercial and business aspects to it. And yet, say that again.
Where was this?
In Langkawi, out in Malaysia.
All right, yeah.
Where they snort the joint.
You know, they snort it good and proper.
Where was the tour on that particular one? Where did you fly through? Was that India into out into Malaysia?
Yeah, we went. We went all the way through Saudi Arabia and then Dubai. We did Abu Dhabi. We displayed India. And then we went Pakistan briefly.
Yeah, the route was, yeah, we did Oman. Then it was going out. It was Oman, Karachi, Delhi, and then Chiang Mai, and then Bangkok, and then Bangkok down to Langkawi.
Yeah.
Then they were all about sort of hour and a half in a hawk.
Yeah, and that's the amazing thing, JB. And that's why I massively take my hat off to the Reds. You know, a good friend of ours, Finn Monaghan, was in charge of them essentially when they did the tour of China. Actually, at the same time we were in Japan 3 or 4 years ago, and the logistics of doing this when you're in an aeroplane that doesn't have an air-to-air refueling capability, you know, and for guys like Duncan Parkey, who are, I mean, it almost looks like you don't get out the cockpit for the entirety of this tour. Where, you know, you're changing time zones, you've got to be rested to do displays and so on. You're doing displays in locations that you've never seen before. You know, I personally think it's a hell of an ask on the pilots, and to do it faultlessly, as it looked like in the States, and I'm sure it was when you guys were doing it, I just think is amazing.
Yeah,
the boys will have done a brilliant job, but I mean, you've picked up brilliant. I think people don't realise the stresses and strains of going and doing that, but you've hit the nail on the head there.
But isn't that the art of good teamwork, though? The more effortless it looks, the better you're doing, the harder it is.
Yeah, almost certainly. I think you know, it is particularly, you know, going across time zones, as God is saying, no matter where you're going and displaying, there will be a pull on you, not only in a piloting capacity, but in a social capacity as well, because, you know, people, the dignitaries that you've gone and displayed for will want to meet the pilots. And it's all a pull on your time when actually, you know, you've got to stay rested, you've got to stay focused, and you've got to look towards the next display and what that's going to involve. And probably, you know, you're going to have to transit somewhere else, which may involve two gusting, three hops, you know, across time zones into different countries, you know, and just getting the aeroplanes there, navigating the aeroplanes, you know, across international borders and getting to the correct place at the correct time.
No.
It's not something that's particularly.
So you just kept a bit, boys.
Yes.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Oh,
okay.
He's back. Yeah.
Hello.
Ah.
Yeah. We got right now.
Now. Maybe. I'm sorry I don't have both your CVs immediately in front of me. Both you and Parky were on the Reds, right? And didn't one of you instruct on the Reds?
Well, we both did. Yeah, we both. Yeah, it's just the way that it works, you know. Is you start in the first year and you learn from the boys above you, and then you
You weren't in a position to fail lads that came on board, no?
Well, it's not really as black and white as that, because you're not someone's particular instructor per se, but you look at a manoeuvre, and if someone struggles with that manoeuvre, then people try and work out ways to get over that problem that they have. And do you know what? I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, Parko, but I think, you know, the only time people have stopped flying on the team is generally when they have an accident. So if it gets to the point where there's an accident, then of course, you know, there's an investigation into that. I can't think of anyone who has been sort of retired early, gracefully removed from the team. Can you, Parko?
No, not really. And you're right. It's just, you know, struggling with the odd, generally second half manoeuvres, isn't it? And, you know, helping them out, maybe the odd duel. You were the exec, weren't you, Dunk? So you did the flying test like I did with the mates. So
yeah.
You know, on the short this week, you flew and you sort of checked out the boys in the back, and then you sort of have a chat with the boss about it. You'd fly on his wing. That's kind of how it worked. And it was you just get a feel for the boys, and you do pick guys that you're fairly, you can't guarantee, but as close as you can, that they're going to hack it. And that was kind of the philosophy.
Yeah. Do you think there's an element of pre-selection, which is why both of you can't actually think of of any guys that didn't really make it?
Yeah, the flying test, you know, some of the boys wouldn't have flown a Hawk for, you know, a few years, and without any practice, really, you know, you're into four loops and four rolls in a couple of positions on the wing of another Hawk. And, you know, that does, you know, that's quite an A-level flying test, that sort of 20 minutes. And you can learn a lot from that, I think. And, you know, the boys, you know, their flying reports would be very good. And, you know, some of the manoeuvres, you know, they do look quite difficult, but, you know, it's just something that you just, you just practice and you just get it. And you know, luckily the success rate is high.
Ah, excellent.
And I think, you know, the way that the team, because I think since we've left the team, there's been quite a lot of focus. Justin Hughes started his business called Mission Excellence, didn't he, that sort of looked at how the Red Arrows do business, how they criticize each other in a hopefully a constructive way. But the process that the team uses in terms of brief, fly, debrief three times a day, and it's relentless. But you'll go and do a sortie. Yeah, so, you know, between these manoeuvres, whoever was the guy, so perhaps for the front five, number five would probably be at the back of the formation watching how that particular manoeuvre went. You'd have a quick debrief in the air before doing it again, debrief in the air, do it again, et cetera, et cetera. And then you'd go and debrief it on video on the ground, and then try and put a little bit more meat on the bones to tell people, right, you need to, you know, stay at full power at that point for whatever it is, don't back off. And as Parky said, through practice and practice and practice, all of these fairly complex manoeuvres, they just come good.
JB,
just the sort of the going around the world bit, that, especially for the boss, I think that was stressful. That was once you do the show, it's kind of like a rehearsal. I wouldn't say it's the easy bit, but it's absolutely what you know and you can do.
Yeah.
But taking Tenkaru to 11 jets and, you know, just going around the world into international airports and, you know, it's quite a busy schedule to get through them. You know, I think it was monsoon season when we were there. We had definitely had some interesting weather. And that could be A-level.
Yeah, I bet.
Just, you know, I can remember, I don't know, do you think when I talk about Chiang Mai, one of the guys, it's funny how the Reds do the radio, and I'm sure they probably still do it the same, but one of the guys would be speaking to air traffic, and you have two radios in the Hawk, and you'd have almost like a chat amongst the flight, and then one guy, and you could listen to him, everybody would, he'd be talking to air traffic and like an airliner reading back the clearances and doing various bits. But the procedure was then another guy would jump across to the tower frequency and just kind of pre-warn the tower that the red arrows are inbound. You'd maybe be, you know, 30 miles out. You're going to be there in sort of 4 minutes or whatever, 5 minutes. And you just warn them and try and kind of bond with air traffic, get a little bit of clearance. And I can remember, I don't know who it was going into Chiang Mai, and you'd literally sometimes go, I'll just chop the tower now. And I just listen out. And I don't know if it was Dunk or whatever, but essentially he's talking to a girl in Chiang Mai traffic saying, red arrows, we're going to be with you in about 4 minutes. We're going to do a looping left-right break, and we'd like permission for all 11 aircraft to land. And there was just this stony silence. And then she came back and went, you're going to do what? And this conversation lasted the entire 5 minutes as he tried to explain that we're going to loop information and then we're going to break left and right-hand circuits and kind of land behind each other. And that was impossible to describe. And I ended up having tears in my eyes, you know, landing, because it was just so funny. And there was so many weird little bits with the Reds. Those are where almost the things happen that you really remember. It's very strange.
Now, tell me this. When you're all in your red flying suit... Oh, I want to talk about flying suits later too. When you're in your red flying suits and you're on the ground and you've had a good display and there's some very wealthy dignitaries there and, you know, heads of foreign governments, who are the coolest people that you've met? Who are the unusual people that have asked, you know, for you to go for a drink or whatnot? And are you allowed to say?
For the listeners, I'm looking at their faces. Looking at their faces, and I do believe there are stories that probably shouldn't be told on this pod.
No, I just remember who we met in Newcastle, Dunk, after the Great North Run.
Right. Oh, yeah. We don't want to talk about that. No. Yeah.
Brilliant. No. Great listening, boys.
I mean, we can say his name. It's not like he's Voldemort or anything, is it? No,
you met Voldemort?
He's not Lord Voldemort.
Although he was Lord Voldemort.
He's probably hated more than him.
Who?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, worse than Voldemort. Do you know what? I was literally about to say as a joke then.
Yeah,
that was on the tip of my tongue, but I thought, no, that'd be in bad taste.
No, yeah. And then we bumped into...
Yeah.
Where's Malaysia? But there's
God is just giving us the general's giving us the cutthroats.
Not appropriate for an all age.
The general's not happy.
Why is that general waving his arms around while on camera?
General's gone off on one. Do you know what? It was a bit funny like that. I don't know. Can you remember any? Even on that tour, I think the fact is we would be. You'd get on the ground. We did meet the King of Malaysia. That was pretty cool. Wasn't it?
There you go. Yeah. Why didn't you go with King of Malaysia?
How can you not come out with that first? And in the end, Parky brings up someone that he really shouldn't have brought up.
Sorry.
Yeah. Who really lost in the memory parking?
Yeah, you sort of meet prime ministers and bits and bobs and
which prime ministers?
Sportsmen, women.
Prime minister of Poland.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Is it president or prime minister?
Now, was that the one with that was a twin?
Oh, I don't know about that.
I'm sure it's prime minister or president that was a twin.
Well, it might have been his twin then. Might have just nipped along. We couldn't tell.
One was a defence secretary, one was a prime minister, and if you remember, one of them died on a plane trip to Russia.
You are full of unbelievably obscure information.
I don't think the death of a foreign leader is obscure.
But when did it happen?
Oh, I'd say...
It wasn't last week, was
oh,
it?
Oh, I'd say 3 years ago. Four years ago. Something like that.
We were in the Reds 15 years ago.
Okay, maybe not him then.
No.
Are there prime ministers?
Oh, now you're asking. Put us on the spot now. Not happy with a prime minister and a king. He wants more.
I like it. President. Royalty.
Exactly. Give us a president. All right, we met the president of Mozambique.
No. Here we go. I can't pronounce his name, but the fourth president of the Republic of Poland died 10th of April 2010.
Ooh. No, we'd left. We're long, long before that.
After a Polish Air Force Tu-154 crashed outside of Smolensk.
Oh, dear.
Killing all 96 on board, which is obviously a great thing.
Yeah, there was a lot of senior people on board that as well, weren't there?
Yeah, loads. Oh,
over the evening, isn't it?
So we got into this over tours around places and how difficult the logistics are. So I did also have to mention, they'd just taken a three-week break, but the Silver Spitfire, who got to Japan... and is now pressed off and is in India, which I think is flipping amazing. So, you know, not overly far off circumnavigating the globe, which I think is utterly brilliant. So
it
all the best to the boys out there.
Yeah.
I had a quick chat with Smithy, who said he essentially had to do a rhubarb raid into Japan from the north because the weather was so bad when they were getting in there, got delayed by weather all over the place. But I think, you know, what an amazing effort.
Did they come in about 4 weeks ago then to Japan?
Yeah, it was something like that.
A typhoon Hibiscus or whatever the hell it's called.
Haggibus.
Yeah, I call it, yeah. What, it's definitely not Hibiscus, I can tell you that much.
Yeah. They pre-planned to stop there anyway because the aircraft needed maintenance because it's halfway around the world for them. So they sort of wrapped her up, put her in a hangar once they'd done the maintenance, and then sort of waited out for a couple of weeks and just started again a week ago.
Did they take their own maintenance there? They're followed by another aircraft, aren't they?
Yeah.
PC-12.
Sorry, what is that its designation? Is that the model number?
No, it's a Pilatus. It's kind of like it's a single engine turboprop with about six seats in it.
Oh, I've seen
and
it.
A lot of Spitfire spares and wheels. And
oh, it's not very big, is it?
Yeah.
Not a huge, made in Switzerland, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He showed me around it when I was, when they were leaving, you know, when they left Goodwood. And yeah, it was chocker.
It's a cool looking thing, isn't it? It's kind of like, not to be too funny about it. It's sort of like a business Cessna.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. So good luck to those boys. And the final person I wanted to mention was little Jacob the pilot. Have you guys seen this on Twitter? I know, JB, we'd had a discussion, but it turns out that little fella amazingly has just raised $6,500 for the RAF Benevolent Fund. They got in touch with me. In fact, it's an answer to my request for questions this evening, where they wanted to shout out where, you know, this little fella, and if you haven't seen him on Twitter, go and have a look, is only 6 years old. So, you know, he's been helped out by his families here, but a fascination with aeroplanes. And he's doing a Dunkirk challenge next year. And amazingly, seeing as I've only just read this, but he is following the 25-kilometer route that Al Deer took to escape out of Dunkirk when he got shot down. So the exact story that Parky was talking about from the book Nine Lives that we mentioned at the beginning of the pod. Jacob's doing that next year. And I'm just looking at his Just Giving page. And already, for a £2,000 target for something next year in 2020, they've raised £1,000 already. So for a little six-year-old lad who's full of the joys of spring and loves seeing aeroplanes and wearing his little flying suit, what a flipping good effort for all that fundraising.
Yes, quite.
That's well, amazing, isn't it? Well done, Jacob. You are the boy. Yeah. Quite literally, the boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, hey, boy. Quite literally the boy.
Do we have any questions, Goddess?
It could be a future Tempest pilot.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just had to... Brilliant. Yes, of course, because there's a new Tempest coming out, isn't there?
Yeah.
Do we have any questions?
Yes, we do.
Fire away.
Here's a good one. So this one's from Daniel Hodgson. Can someone explain to me the milk-based banter I often see exchanged between ex-Harrier pilots on the Twitter sphere? Dying to know? Question mark.
I have not noticed this.
Well, it's normally... there is something, and we'll see in a minute if Goddard knows any further where it's from. But it was always something that was banter to the Harrier force that they drank milk and ate quiche. And it was, you know... that was always the banter, I guess, because, you know, back in the day, not that long ago, the RAF was a fairly hard drinking organization. And it when you look back and if I go back to First Light and reading that and the drinking culture that the Air Force had back then, because really they were, you know, surviving day to day. So, you know, they had, you know, a number of, they'd go down the pub most nights. So I guess, you know, that each fighter force probably enjoyed the odd trip to the pub or two. But it was sort of seen that the Harrier force didn't, that rather than do that, they stayed at home and drank milk and ate quiche. But I don't know where the quiche came from, whether that was just a throwaway on top of the milk.
So, it sounds like the ultimate insult to me.
Yeah, well, or indeed whether perhaps a particularly well-known Harrier pilot did actually drink milk. I don't know. Have you heard of you know this? Goddess has gone. He's gone quiet. Goddess, completely
very mild.
He's got a mouthful of quiche.
The whispering gentle.
It's exactly that. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's exactly that, Dunk. It was from a time when men were men. You know, it was one of those things. So back in the sort of 60s, 70s. And I think when the Harrier first came in, you know, it's probably all over YouTube now, but you remember they'd show us the horror video of people doing the V-stall, you know, the vertical short takeoff and landing stuff when they first got into the aeroplane, and you just saw people falling out of the sky, jets crashing nose on, all of this sort of stuff. And it was, especially the early models were hellish difficult to fly. So I think it came from one of those things, you know, the F4 pilots or whatever would be in the bar. You know, but the Harrier pilots would leave a bit earlier because they knew that if they got into that aeroplane and tried to do some V-stall the next day, and they weren't on the top of their game, it wasn't going to happen, or you could die. So I think that's where it started from. But yeah, it was definitely a bit of old school stuff.
It's a good question. That a really good question.
Any input, Parky? I see you smiling and nodding. What about from the other side of the fence?
I have a few recollections of, you know, the odd beer on the Phantom Force, maybe one or two on a Friday.
It's why you look 300 now.
So Lisa
Harding, this is funny. I'm not asking my question again. You know what it is. And that is about us doing a live pod. Will someone, for the love of God, please sort this out? I want to do it.
You're the general. Yeah. You've just done a leadership course.
Do one of your
for goodness sake, show some leadership and bloody
that's
lead us
right.
there.
I forgot
we'll follow
it's
you anywhere.
My fault, even though Parky lives 3 feet from the Petwood.
Well, yeah, but I'm not, you know, in the RAF, but you could delegate it to a, you know, a flight lieutenant, for example.
Lisa, we are going to sort this out one way or another. Here's an interesting one. How much, I guess we've kind of alluded to this, Charlie Leon, how much has the Royal Air Force changed over the course of your careers, and how do you see the RAF in 10 years' time? There's a question.
That is a question.
Crikey, how long have we got?
You were in for at least 50 years.
Yeah, the first part of it is it's changed a lot. And the second bit is probably going to change more. I mean, I guess, you know, the first thing is just extraordinary how many, just in terms of fast jets, you know, when I finished TAC Weapons, I think we had 9 types you could choose from. I mean, it was mental, really, just, you know, Phantoms, Lightnings, Buccaneers, Jaguars, Harriers, Tornadoes. It just an extraordinary array of aircraft and just loads of squadrons. And, you know, there was just lots of flying to be had. That's how I sort of recall it, obviously, probably, you know, rose-tinted glasses. But it was busy. There was loads of flying. There was a little bit of that culture. You know, you had fun and it was enjoyable. You know, we did loads of flying and lots of great stuff. And you know, it's without doubt, it's just more professional, for want of a better word. I still think we flew hard and we worked hard, but, you know, the world's changed a bit and that's where we're at. How does that sound, Goddess?
I think you're about right, you know, and I do like your comment about more professional. Not that we weren't back in the day, but I think, JB, it would, you know, I was using the American football earlier. This is the rugby equivalent of, you know, not high-end amateurs, but the way professionalism has changed.
Yeah, over, a lot of fun of that.
You know, over the last 15 to 20 years. I mean, you would have seen that as a, you know, as a rugby player at a club.
Yeah.
You know, how that sort of stuff has changed. So I think it's exactly the same.
Yeah, the problem is, like, thought, Goddess, is I don't think it works very well. So... there's one thing to be professional if you're an accountant. There's another thing to be professional if you are asked to do extraordinary things on a daily basis. So I'll just relate that to rugby. You know, if you want to go out and do extraordinary things in unusual manners, to say the least, and I think that professionalisation in rugby takes the edge off lads, personally. I like my rugby players, particularly in the era, to be a bit more hard drinking, a little bit rough edges, and a little bit, how can I say, a little bit harsher with each other, because I think that's what it takes when you go
on the
field.
So my point about the professionalism is not that everyone was an amateur back in the day razzing around the place, but it's Parkey's point, for example, about snorting or snotting.
Yes.
You know, there isn't a junior pilot out there right now who would consider, you know, a low level flyby on a departure from an air show or something along those sorts of lines.
Are you sure, General?
Yeah, but why not? Well, I mean, do you not think that? But, I mean, don't you think that is absolutely absurd?
You know,
I mean, if
the half, no, because the half of it, Dunk, is there's it comes down to the point there are fewer people around, and just as in every walk of life, the social media means that everything you do is on camera and will be on camera. And I mean, and you know this from Afghanistan and the, you know, the takeoffs and, you know, people standing with cameras at the end of the runway, you know, and that's in a sort of a, you know, a wartime scenario where you know, there was a reason for those sorts of takeoffs in case people are firing, you know, stuff at you. That's what I mean by the, you know, maybe it's the wrong word in terms of professionalism.
I think I know where you're going with it. But I would just say, aren't you looking for daring young men? And if they won't dare to do, like, you know, a low-level fly pass, what else would they not dare to do?
Well, no, I'm not sure that's true. Just to go back, so, this is a good question because it's generated quite a lot of
heat
of talk, hasn't it? But you see, I disagree, Goddess. I think there's a real step change in actually. It's not the professionalism. It's not. It's actually what we're doing. When you look back at even when we joined, but certainly when you and I joined, we were in the Cold War era. So we're in a very, very different place. And so we would train differently. I think maybe it's rose-tinted glasses as well, but I think that we were just as professional. I think the professionalism hasn't changed. And I think, but the job has, because we...
I was about to say this, but because I think we're asking more of a youngster coming through now in what they do than they did of us.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, well, yes and no. I think we'd have stepped up to the plate. It's just that now there is a very different environment that people are going, and that you know, the combat environment that the Air Force is still very much involved in, whether it be rotary, multi-engine, or fast jet. The pace of it, I think, is greater. The pace is greater than it was when we were training for you know, the Red Fury to come over the fence, weren't we? And so the fact is that that's kind of all we were doing. And then when Iraq and Afghanistan started, that started to change the face of what the Royal Air Force was doing.
Well, no, I was going to make this exact point in the, you know, you say we started in the Cold War. We didn't, you know, with the first Gulf War started with me and you just down the corridor from each other going through Cromwell. And pretty much everyone has been on operations almost all of the time since then in some way, shape or form. Mm. And I think that has led to a, you know, a different attitude that, from my time up at Lossie, you know, and you mentioned are you dislocated from reality there, General? The reason I'd go out and visit squadrons when they were away, you know, away from the home base, was just to see exactly that, you know, what were they like? And there is absolutely still the esprit de corps and the element of fun that you would recognize from the Second World War or the First World War. That side of it is exactly the same. But you to multi-role aeroplane, for example, you know, we are asking so much more with the multiple different weapon types. I mean, there's bound to be a few listeners who are going to disagree with me of the pilots coming through in, you know, the sort of level that they have to be at and the professionalism that they have to demonstrate. Because, you know, just consider going out to Syria or, you know, going out to Cyprus now and flying a mission out of there with all of the procedures that you're looking at, the different roles of engagement. You know, look at that particular airspace right now with Syrians, Russians, Iraqis, you know, all sorts of stuff going on out there, the stuff going on the ground. It is unbelievably complex. When we grew up in a world where, you know, close air support, here's your forward line of own troops, here's something else, here's a quick grid reference, go and bomb it. Don't worry too much about the rules of engagement, you know, with an iron non-laser guided bomb. That, I think, drives a professionalism because you have to be disciplined in order to do all of these different roles and be good at all these different roles. That's, I think, what I mean by the professionalism side.
Yeah.
But you've still got this thread of fun.
And I think, you know, the boys always were, you know, you fought and operated your aircraft absolutely as a squadron, you know, to the...
Yeah, and I don't mean you didn't do that.
You know, certainly in the air defence world on the F4, F3, there were... You know, we would do an APC, so every year you'd go and shoot the gun at the flag in Cyprus. You'd do deches, so air sort of combat range against whoever, you know, for a few weeks. There'd be squadron exchanges. There would be. It was such great fun, you know, from one of the, and you were professional with it. And you did your bits, but it was utterly, utterly brilliant job because there was so much flying to be had and so much fun flying to be had.
Well, I think that's key as well.
QRA and you intercepted the Russians and you did all of those bits as well. But it's, you know, times have moved on and it is now, you know, more of the world has just explained. And I think that does change the way the boys fly and how they operate their jets now.
But I think it's also the amount of flying that you've alluded to, the fact that that's reduced, the fact that, you know, going to an air show. You know, when I was a flying officer flying, I was holding, waiting. So I had my wings, I'd done Chivna, and I was waiting then to go to an OCU. And I was holding down at St. Athan. And I took the hawk that had it was a black dragon on it, painted on the side of this hawk. I went to an air show in the summer every weekend. But now, you see, that sort of thing is gone. And that sort of culture, and it is a culture that's changed. So we say about, you know, doing the fly pass and doing those low fly pass, the opportunity for people to actually get involved in those things has changed. And I think, you know, we've realized as well, and we've grown and learned from the fact that people can get themselves into all sorts of trouble. And, you know, it was the age-old adage within the Air Force was the most dangerous time of an air show was when everyone was departing, because, you know, that's when boys went, hey, I've been on the beer all weekend and I was the static crew, and now watch this as they depart, you know, and they would beat up the joint. But I think there's less and less opportunity for that happen. But I don't disagree, but there is also the social media aspect that you speak about, Goddard, and the fact that that does undoubtedly keep people honest.
Yeah, which going back to that original point, don't you think that is an enhanced degree of, I can't think of a better word, you know, Parky mentioned it, but sort of professionalism there.
Yeah, yeah, I guess you're right.
So, I think we come around to that. JB, I know what you mean about the sort of...
Go on.
The rough around the edges, rugby player, the sort of, the trouble is when you get that sort of person, it's almost mercurial, isn't it? Mercurial means up and down. You can have amazing days and you can have bad days. I'm not sure it's the same. Definitely from my time, a couple of years up at Lossie, people seemed to be having fun. Again, it was always difficult when you're the commander and the leader trying to test the water there. But
Spacious coming round, pretend to be having fun, everyone.
Yeah, pretend to be having fun, everyone.
Laugh harder.
Are you having fun? Yes, sir.
And my final point on this.
Go on.
This is the best question we've ever had. My final point on this is I went to a... leadership was one of the chief of the air staff's leadership conferences a couple of years ago, and they had a psychologist on stage who talked about leading the next generation. And his point was that there isn't really a next generation. The generations are not different. It's just us that has changed. We've grown older. We've become the grumpy. It wasn't as good in my day. Every single person in the history of time, when they get into their sort of late 30s, early 40s, 50s, talks about the halcyon rose-tinted days, and it's not as good as it was.
So I have a theory, right?
Which is an interesting...
That there are institutions out there which just know how to get things done. And I would suggest that the armed forces of the UK in particular are those institutions. And I do worry about when corporate speak and psychologists and all this start getting involved in military stuff, because although they might add something... very, very substantial, very valuable. I don't think it overtakes the values of the institution itself, which have been honed over, in the UK's case, literally hundreds of years. And that's always my worry.
And that is your final word.
Done.
Right, so final question then. Because otherwise we're going to bore people to death. But
it's my wedding anniversary tonight as well. I might be in trouble.
No, you'll be all right. So this is from Robert McLennan. Oh, yeah, I like questions like this. What period of flight history would you have liked to have been involved in? My interest is at Edwards Air Force Base in the 40s, 50s and 60s. Now, interestingly...
Why would that be then?
Well, so I watched The Right Stuff again on the aeroplane out to the States about a month ago.
Yeah.
And when you look at Jaeger and those boys going up and... just amazing. They didn't know we're going to break up. All of those pictures on the wall that they end up having a drink to, because those are the pilots that have stoofed in. The family's there wondering whether, the guy in the dark suit is going to appear on the drive. And if you did get it right and you did manage to, work out that the airplane was going sideways just prior to Mach 1 because the controls had reversed and you managed to get it going again, you went through Mach 1, became the first person to go supersonic, et cetera, et cetera. I could see why that would be an exciting time. I think probably all of us are back in the 40s somewhere, because that's probably where our hearts lie. But I don't know. Dunk?
It's a very difficult one, isn't it? It's... because it is easy to think, well, to romanticize about it. But, go back to our book club and you go back to mention of Geoffrey talking about the despair and fear that he felt before going flying, and Pierre Klosterman's book, The Big Show, and how he wrote about it, the just total fear. Ken Wilkinson used to say that the reason he could do it was because he believed he was already dead. And so those things make you think, it sounds great because, you'd be part of this part of history. But I'm not sure if the romantic side of it is quite what it would have been like. I think just post-war into the jet age would have been really interesting. So I think, as our question asker says, the 40s, 50s, 60s must have been a fascinating time, and particularly as aviation was developing so quickly. I think probably just post-war into that, for me, that sort of early jet age.
Yeah.
Okay.
Pogo?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. We've had two belters, really. We could have done a whole podcast on the last two questions. But, yeah, for interesting stuff, I was just, as you were saying that, Dunk, I was, you know, just blown away. I remember when the when the two Lancs were here and there was some Arvo chat and they were saying that there was 11 years between the Lancaster and the Vulcan flying. And, you know, it's just extraordinary, that technological advance. You know, almost overnight aircraft were outdated and jumping in and the different types that the boys flew, you know, the Eric Winkle Brown story is just, you know, it will never, ever happen again. It can't, you know, it's just incredible era of flying. And probably you've nailed it. You know, that was when the most advances happened. And, you know, every other week it must have been, you won't believe what we've built now. Have a look at this thing, you know. Wow.
Roll that out. Yeah. I'll tell you what, you know, the era we've ended up flying in hasn't been all bad either, has it?
No.
You know, it'd be a difficult thing to go, you know, go and swap it all, as much as we love all of that old stuff. I feel so lucky to have flown the aeroplanes that I've flown and done the stuff that we've done, you know, over the last 30 years or so. That's been flipping amazing.
I tell you when would have been cool. Either right at the start, especially in civils, doing something weird like the postal run between Cuba and Florida, which is, I think, sort of... I mean, something being right on the edge like that would have been flipping amazing. So
yeah, like, that's back, true, actually, JB.
Yeah, like back in the days where you could basically buy yourself a seaplane and set up an airline. I mean, that sounds pretty awesome.
I'll tell you what, on that note, before we started the pod, I was just watching on Channel 5 there, the thing on 100 years of British Airways, and starting off as a little outfit flying out of Croydon Airport across to across to France, and then becoming Imperial Airways, and then the transition to British Overseas. And so that they showed right at the beginning the sort of stuff you're talking about. And I was just joking with the family there, you know, that you've got this massive biplane tail dragger with all the people sat down the back, and these two little pilots perched on the top in this open cockpit of this, you know, behemoth as it, you know, toodled off to France.
I mean, can
and
you?
They said it was.
Can you imagine how exciting it'd be at BOAC when they got the first Comet? I mean, let's not dwell on what eventually happened to the Comet, but it must have been absolutely brilliant. Or when they were trying to fly, what was that enormous aircraft which was meant to be an airliner of the a cruise ship of the sky? How was that? The Shorts, a massive Shorts aircraft. And the other job, which would have been really cool, post-war, sort of coming into the jet age, being a salesman for someone like de Havilland or Buccaneer with all these various types, or English Electric, that would be seriously cool.
Well, I wouldn't want to be a salesman, JB. You could do that. But
yeah, you know, exactly. But I'd love to have my hands on all
that's
kit.
That's a cool pitch.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, showing up to somewhere like, I don't know, straight.
Lightnings.
Hey, yeah, and don't remember, the salesman, right? You may laugh at salesmen, but the salesman for all these aircraft companies, all used to be the test pilots. They'd be in, like, a three-piece suit or some sort of striped double-breasted thing. Like, finish lunch, jump into an aircraft, fly it around, land again, finish off lunch. It's a brilliant life.
Yeah, that would have been the way.
You have sold that well. Yeah, you've turned that round. Well done, Jay.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that also ends very sadly in Farnborough. But, you know, still.
Yes, yes. Well, what a podcast. It's probably
what a return, eh? What was worth waiting for.
Yeah, really lit the afterburners there. Excellent. Well, if you don't mind, boys, I'll bring this home. Thank you, Godders, Parky, and Dunk. And remember, you can find us only on Twitter. We're not going to pretend that we're going to do anything else. That's at Pilot Episodes Pod, where you can send us a little direct message if you don't want to tweet us. If you've got a question, just leave something there. If you just want to get involved with the conversation, please do. And maybe we'll get back next month, eh?
We'll do it.
Definitely. We, you know, Parky's got more time these days.
Of course. Well, if he's not hibernating.
I might have passed my
ILT
by then.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, well, we can all check in then. So from us four, thank you for listening, and we'll catch you very soon. Goodbye.
Bye.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.